So, waiting. We have a proverb in Swedish that translated, he who waits for something good never waits too long. And I guess the English equivalent is probably good things come to those who wait, something similar. And both of them are obviously meant to encourage us to be patient. I'm not sure it always works, and I'm not sure it's always true either. But it's a good point. And I think the nation of Israel, they knew the feeling, because they'd been promised great things. They'd been promised great kings. But those things seemed to be taking forever. They'd been promised a king like David and a prophet like Moses, both of which could be summed up in this title, Messiah, which means anointed. Because both kings and prophets were anointed. Kings were anointed literally with oil, often by prophet, pouring oil on their heads. Prophets, more metaphorically, anointed by the Holy Spirit to speak God's words. Messiah, anointed. And the main prophet promise, that wasn't in the passage that Dudley read, the main prophet promise is in Deuteronomy 18. I will raise up for them, for the people, a prophet like you, that's referring to Moses, from among the fellow Israelites, and I will put my words in his mouth. He will tell them everything I command him. So here is the promise of this prophet, not just a prophet, kind of like Elijah and Elisha and Gad and all sorts of people who spoke from God. The people of God had those all through the Old Testament, but a special prophet with a capital P, if you like. And that's what the priests and the scribes in John chapter 1 are referring to when they come to John the Baptist and they're asking, are you the prophet? Because they knew that one day there would be not just a prophet, but the prophet. That's what they're asking John the Baptist. Are you the prophet? And John the Baptist denies it, rightly so, because he wasn't the prophet. In the passage that Dudley wrote, no, he didn't write it, he read it. Let's hope he didn't rewrite the passage before he read it to us. The passage that Dudley read in Jeremiah 33, there the focus is on the promise of the king that would be like King David. David, despite his faults, was the greatest king that Israel ever had, and that is what all the prophecies about the king are looking back to, King David. Now, most of this chapter, Jeremiah 33, as far as we can tell, is actually talking about Israel's restoration from the Babylonian exile. And in the midst of that, we find this prophecy about the righteous branch from David's line, this true and good king. That was hardly fulfilled when the Israelites returned from exile in the 6th century BC. Verse 14 also starts off with the days are coming, which is maybe an indication that God is no longer talking about the same period that he was talking about in the preceding paragraphs. He's looking further ahead. And then he promises to fulfill the good promise, the gracious promise made to Israel, the promise of a righteous king from David's line. Do you know where the original promise was made? It was made to King David, obviously. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 7. I will raise up your offspring to succeed you. I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now that kind of, it's a very grand promise. It's a truly good promise. And God elaborates on it here in Jeremiah 33. And as a matter of fact, he elaborated on it in chapter 23 as well. It's such an important promise that Jeremiah, or God through Jeremiah, actually gives the same promise twice, in chapter 23 and here in chapter 33. And it's a good promise because it's not just promising a king. Israel had a lot of kings. And when the kingdom divided into Judah and Israel, they had a double set of kings, one in the south and one in the north. And most of them weren't actually very good. So not just a king. Kings are 13 a dozen. Not just a descendant of King David, because again, good ancestry doesn't necessarily guarantee high quality. Judah had a lot of kings that were descendants of David and the majority of them were, well, below par, shall we say, a bit lacking. So he's not just promising a king, he's not just promising a descendant of David, but he's promising a righteous king, a righteous branch of David's line. Because it's important that your king is righteous, especially if this is going to be a great king, an eternal king. And if you're not sure what a righteous ruler is in this context, well, the next line clarifies that he will do what is just and right in the land. That is what it means to be a righteous king, a righteous ruler. Israel had a lot of experience with bad rulers. So the promise of a righteous ruler would go down well with the original voters, hearers. And it should resonate with us as well. Because whichever way you lean politically, I think we can agree that most of our rulers, whether we're looking at monarchs or prime ministers or MPs in general or local rulers, most of them aren't exactly outstanding moral examples. And I, for one, long for righteousness and justice and compassion in this world rather than greed and selfishness and racism and injustice and all these things that we do see, not just in the rulers, but in most ordinary people as well. We need a just and righteous king, a righteous ruler. And that is what God promises. And when God promises something, we know it's not just empty words, right? So if God says that he will send the righteous king, you can rest assured he will send the righteous king. God keeps his words. Now you may be a bit confused by that word branch. Why is this king called a branch? Well, it's a tree image. Trees are branches. You knew that, didn't you? And they sometimes fall on the road when we have a storm. But that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about the exile. The family tree of David, the royal family, would be cut down, as it were. The exile would kind of take away the Davidic king from the throne. And as a matter of fact, there wasn't really any descendants of David on the throne of Israel after the exile either. There was this one leader, it's called Zerubbabel. I think that's how we say it. Is that correct, Jenny? Zerubbabel is a great name. And he did lead the nation after the exile, especially in rebuilding the temple with the help of some of the prophets and Ezra and Nehemiah. But he wasn't a true king in the sense that King David and King Solomon had been, because they were still under the thumb of the Persian Empire. They had been allowed to go back home, but Israel was still part of the Persian Empire. And as far as I can work out, no descendant of David ever ruled over an independent Israel again, because even after the exile, the nation of Israel was really never independent. They were ruled by different empires. Well, there was a short period, but the Greeks ruled them, and then the Romans came along. But this prophetic title, the branch, is the promise. It kind of puts some hope into the picture, promising that one day the family tree of David will sprout again. It looks like it's been cut down. It looks like we're not seeing any kings descended from David anymore. But one day that will happen. One day the family tree will sprout and the family of David will bring forth a righteous ruler. This was so important that God told Israel the same thing through the prophet Isaiah. In Isaiah 11, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit. That's, by the way, where the words in O come Emmanuel, a rod of Jesse's stem, that's where that comes from, the stump of Jesse. Jesse was King David's father. So here's a prophecy in Isaiah about this branch. Funnily enough, Isaiah uses a different word for branch. It's good to have a language with a lot of synonyms. Usually English has more synonyms than any other language, but Here, Hebrew uses different words for branch. And Isaiah uses the word netzer, which just happens to be the same root as the name of an obscure Galilean village, which is famous only for its one illustrious rabbi. That's the village of Nazareth. And it's quite possible that when Matthew says in his gospel that the Old Testament actually predicted that a Messiah would be called Nazarene, he is thinking of the branch prophecies. That he's thinking of Isaiah 11, the branch from the branch village. And even if that is a bit tenuous, not everybody agrees with that in understanding of it, I think it makes perfect sense. But even if you think that is stretching it a bit, it helps us transition to what you've obviously already worked out is the conclusion to all of this, that the righteous king promised by Jeremiah, the branch promised by Isaiah, is of course Jesus. That's what all of that was leading up to. You know, when I preach, I will always land on Jesus somehow or other. Matthew and Luke both include genealogies, the family tree of Jesus. Matthew starts off with it, and both of them make it very clear that Jesus descended from King David. God's promise to Israel through Jeremiah and through Isaiah that David will never fail to have a descendant on the throne of Israel is fulfilled in Jesus. That is incredibly important to remember. The angel tells Joseph that as well, but let's leave that for now. Currently, of course, Jesus isn't sitting on an earthly throne. He's on the heavenly throne in the heavenly command center. You can read about that in the book of Revelation. One day he will reign visibly, uncontested, when every knee will bow, every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. He is the promised king. He will rule and reign forever. Pilate wasn't wrong when he put King of the Jews on the cross. He just didn't realize that Jesus wasn't just the King of the Jews. He was also the King of the Romans, and the King of the Swedes, King of the Brits, King of the universe. Now, that is probably not particularly controversial. You've probably sung enough carols and heard enough sermons on this to realize that Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise of a descendant of David. But what do we make of the other promise in Jeremiah 33? The Levitical priesthood. Is that supposed to continue forever? Because that has been interrupted since the temple was destroyed in AD 70. That's nearly 2,000 years without any physical ethnic Levitical priests. That's not the main problem, though. The main problem is that the book of Hebrews makes it quite clear that there is no more need for Levitical priests because Jesus is the ultimate priest and the ultimate sacrifice. And I think that means simply that Jesus is the fulfillment of this promise. Jesus fulfills what the Levitical priesthood was pointing towards, forgiveness for sins through the perfect sacrifice. They were imperfect priests who offered imperfect sacrifices. Even though Jesus isn't a Levite, he is the eternal priest who offers a perfect sacrifice himself, and that sacrifice is sufficient for all eternity. So, if the Israelites in the days of Jeremiah were worried about the end of sacrifices, because that to them would mean no more forgiveness, no more access to the throne of God. Well, then Jesus is the fulfillment of this promise, because through Jesus' sacrifice, there is forgiveness and we don't need continual sacrifices anymore. But actually, that's not quite all there is to it, because the New Testament also calls us priests. You remember when I preached on 1 Peter 2? You are a chosen nation, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And in Revelation, we also read that Jesus has made us, as us, to be a kingdom and priests, to serve his God and Father. So actually, we, the people of God, followers of Jesus, we are also the fulfillment of this promise. Following Israel's Messiah, worshipping Israel's God, proclaiming the glory of this God to all nations. It may not be quite what Jeremiah would have imagined as a fulfillment. But then Jeremiah also probably didn't imagine that those innumerable descendants that had been promised to Abraham would be Gentiles. Abraham's children through faith, not through physical descent. Well, it's both, but he wouldn't have predicted that. He wouldn't have been able to imagine that. The book of Hebrews also points out that having priests that are not Levites, as in the case of Jesus, that requires a change in the law, which is exactly what happened when Jesus came. He is the fulfillment of all the prophecies. He is the second Moses, gathering his people, leading his people out of slavery, giving a new summary of the will of God, if you like, inaugurating the new covenant. And by the way, Jeremiah actually predicted a new covenant as well. So because of Jesus coming as a second Moses, the ceremonial or ritual part of the Old Testament law that stipulated that priests had to be Levites, that has been fulfilled. It's fulfilled its purpose, so that part is closed, can be shut and put back on the shelf, as it were. God gave those regulations about priests and sacrifices and all that to Old Covenant Israel. Now that the Messiah has arrived with the New Covenant, we don't need that anymore. So if Jesus is the promised king and the promised prophet, and we are the promised priest, what are we still waiting for? Well, we are still waiting. The word Advent means arrival. And Advent is kind of generally seen as a season of waiting, preparing for this arrival. It's not just getting ready for Christmas. It's actually getting ready for the coming of the King. That's what Advent is all about. Now, we're no longer waiting to find out who this King is, because we know it's Jesus. And by the way, Jesus is often referred to as the Christ, which is simply the same word as the Messiah, meaning anointed. So we're no longer waiting for this to find out who the King is. We're no longer waiting to find out who the prophet is. We know it wasn't John the Baptist. We know it's Jesus. But we also know something that the Old Testament prophets didn't. That the coming of the King and the coming of the kingdom happens in two stages. They didn't see that. And that's why Advent is traditionally seen as celebrating two arrivals. We're preparing to celebrate the first coming of the promised King when he was born as a human baby in Bethlehem. But we're also looking forward to celebrating the second coming, which hasn't happened yet, when this King will come back, return in full glory as King of Kings, no longer as a baby in Bethlehem, but as the King of the universe. So just like the Old Testament people of God, we are still waiting for the righteous King. But there is a big difference as well. We know who he is. We know what he's like. We've already seen some of those righteous things that he has done, like taking our sin and our death on himself so that we can receive his righteousness and his life. That is quite an amazing achievement. Just imagine what he will be able to do when he comes back in full power and glory. We don't know when he's coming back, but we do know that he is. We're a little bit in the situation of these people. Well, maybe not quite, but do you remember The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? Some of us have been to see it at the Mayflower in Southampton recently. There are several different film and video versions of it as well. But as always, the book is better. But anyway, the story is the same. Narnia, this magical land, is in the grip of the White Witch and suffering under eternal winter, where it's never Christmas. But there are four empty thrones in the great castle Caer Peribel. And there is an ancient prophecy saying that when those four thrones are occupied by four humans, two sons of Adam and two daughters of Eve, then the spell will be broken and Narnia will be set free. And so the Narnians wait. The witch, of course, is on the lookout, determined to kill any humans she can find. The talking animals, the rightful inhabitants, are waiting and watching, wanting to make sure that she doesn't succeed. None of them knows how long it's going to take. They don't know when those humans are going to show up, but they are sure it will happen. Aslan has promised it, and Aslan has not abandoned them. It will happen. We just don't know when. And we are kind of like them. Our world is still in the grip of evil. Our world is still in the grip of sin and death. We've had two funerals recently to remind us of that. This world is not as it should be. It may not be physical winter all the time, but as Jenny mentioned in her prayer as well, it's still pretty dark around us. But the righteous king is on his way. And the enemy can't defeat him any more than the white witch could defeat Aslan. Jesus is coming back. We don't know when, but it's a certain promise, because God keeps his promises. And when he does come back permanently, all the prophecies will be fully and completely fulfilled. The people of God will live in safety. Death will be swallowed up in victory. And the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. And that is definitely a good thing that is coming to those who wait. Let's pray.